much for coming out. I don't know that I have enough sheets. I don't know how many sheets I made, but they also were sent out in email, and assuming that you sign in, you will be able to get them digitally after this year. I'll send out the digital copy as well, so that people who may not have a copy for themselves right now will at least have it at that point. I did note in the email that I needed to start promptly, so I'm only starting 3 minutes late, because there is the Yom Iyun for women starting at 10 o'clock in the Rebbetzin Town Hall, and I am supposed to be there. So I'm going to get through as much as I can get through. I want to make sure, though, first, to open with a thank you to QualiCare, and I think we have Wayne and Andrea Nathanson, founders of QualiCare, here in the room. Thank you very much for sponsoring the series, not only the Medical Halacha series here at the Bayit, but also the Medical Halacha series down at Shari Shamayim, enabling us to spread Torah and Halacha. Not that the two are different, but to spread Torah and Halacha for medical professionals and everybody who's interested around the city. So thank you very much for the sponsorship. I also want to make sure to thank everyone who suggested topics for this year. There were way more than I could possibly get to in this session. Even if this session were a full-day seminar, it's still way more than I could possibly get to in this session. So the result of that may be a couple of elder care sessions next year also. We'll have to see, because there were some great topics that I just don't have the ability to get to here. As always, practical halachic questions go to the shul rabbi. Everything I say here is meant to discuss halachic issues and perhaps give some guidance, but ultimately the shul rabbi is the one who sets psak for the community. So for this year, I plan to address items that come up in day-to-day care. There are many, as I said, many important issues I'm not going to get to. One issue in particular that I want to at least mention, because it's so important, is the issue of advanced directives and making sure that that one's wishes are known when one is still able to express them and discuss them with people. And that's something that's of critical importance. It's just beyond the scope of what we're going to get to today, but I want to at least make sure to mention it. Okay. Classically, the Jewish community, when I say classically, I mean going back a couple of thousand years, the Jewish community took care of their elders in the home. Families lived in close units. When the Torah says, Ishu Beiso, a man and his household, the household meant everybody, so that if you look on the sheets, you see in source number one, I brought you a classic quote from a sage by the name of Chizkiah, Amar Chizkiah, Amri Inshi Saba Bevesa Pacha Bevesa, Savta Bevesa Sima Bevesa. He was talking about an issue of Erech, which is beyond the scope of the Shia right now. But he notes that if an old man is in the home, a crack is in the home, meaning that the home starts to fall apart, that the old man does not necessarily contribute so much to the household, whereas the old woman in the household is a treasure in the household. She helps with various things. She is industrious. And without commenting on the implications of this for our males and females and so on, the reason why I mention it is simply because in their day, it's normal that you would have everybody in the family, in the household, including the older male, including the older female. And the Gemara has many stories of interactions between parents and their children as the parents become elderly. This actually may be part of the origin of the practice that some have of not marrying a spouse who is of the same name as one's parent. It's recorded most famously by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, author of the Sefer Chassidim, the practice that if my name is Mordechai, so then my daughter should not marry a man by the name of Mordechai. That tends to be honored in the breach, and we are familiar probably with cases in which people just change the name slightly of someone so they're not called by the same name exactly. But the origin of it may simply be the issue of kavod, the issue of honor for one's parent, because you're going to call your spouse by the first name, and the parent is living there in the house. It creates confusion and disrespect for the parent. As we move into the Middle Ages, in-home care was still the norm, perhaps with outside tzedakah. I gave you a quote from Salo Baron, the famous historian from Columbia University, in source number 2, where he notes the communal organs or special associations under their supervision extended medical and other assistance to ailing persons at their homes. So they would stay in the family home, and they would simply be cared for, perhaps with the help of community tzedakah. In the work History of the Jews in Vienna, there's a historian by the name of Max Grunwald who devotes an appendix to listing the charitable institutions of Viennese Jewry in the Enlightenment era. And he lists hospitals, sanitaria, synagogues, poorhouses, technical institutes. He does not list an elder care institution. At that point, it simply doesn't exist. It's only in modern times. According to the Encyclopedia Judaica, the first modern Jewish home for the elderly was in Amsterdam in 1749. Israel Code, in his History of the Jews in Vilna, lists such an institution in the 19th century. There's more that we could say about this. My point is simply to say the issue of children taking care of their parents or people taking care of the elderly in home as opposed to in a professional dedicated institution is not a new one, and therefore the halachic dilemmas have indeed been discussed down through the ages. So what we're going to talk about relates not just to medical professionals caring for the elderly, but also to children who are taking care of their parents. So the first question that comes up that I'd like to address is the question of who should care for the elderly, such as between siblings, who is the one who's going to take care of the elderly. Take a look, please, on your sheets at source number 3. I didn't do this in the standard vignette format. It really would be a better shear if it was in the vignette format, but just in the interest of sandwiching in as much as possible in the time that we have, I decided to go this route this time. For those who have questions, I still want to take questions during the shear. I don't want to go without that. So please do call out, raise your hand, whatever you like. But that should still happen. So in source number 3, the Shulchan Aruch writes, Echad ha'ish ve'echad ha'isha shavin b'kavod u'v'mora shel av ve'im. Men and women are equally obligated in honor and awe of their parents. Ela she'ha'isha in b'yad alasa she'mishubedes l'bala. But a woman may not be able to, because she is bound to her husband. And what he's talking about there is the fact that the males and the unmarried females are going to be the ones who have first responsibility to care for the parent. However, when a woman gets married, in return for his acceptance of responsibility for her, where the man takes upon himself, he's going to clothe her, he's going to shelter her, and so on, she agrees to put his honor even ahead of that of her parents, that her primary responsibility is going to be to him. I am well aware that a household in which this actually comes to debate, and the husband is going to need to assert his Shulchan Aruch assigned right, is in trouble. This is not necessarily, you don't want a situation in which a husband and a wife are debating, so do we go to your parents or do we not? Well, I am the husband and you have to honor me first. That's not where they need to be having their discussion at that point then. They have bigger issues they need to address. But what the Shulchan Aruch is noting, in general, and the point that I wanted to stress here, is that even though there is this assumption, assumption is probably too strong a word, even though there is this sort of urban wisdom that says that the daughters end up taking care of the parents, the truth of the matter is that the obligation is with the males as well, and perhaps even more so than with the females. So how do you deal with it when, in practice, siblings are faced with the need to care for their parents? In source number 4, the Rama, Ramosha Isserlis, wrote, Vim Yeshlo Banim Rabim Mechashvim Lafi Mamon Shalohem Vim Mitzasan Ashirim Mitzasam Aniyim Mechuyavim Ashirim Levan. He's talking about economic issues in taking care of the parents, and what he says is, if there are many children, then we calculate based on their wealth. It's done based on who has the means to be able to take care. And the same thing will be true if what we're dealing with is not financial care, but what we're talking about is just practically being able physically to take care of the parents. We're going to do it based on which ones have the ability to do so. Clearly, on a practical level, the siblings need to confer on this, and not just confer once before they make whatever arrangement they're making, but confer often, so that they make sure things are balanced between them. I can't tell you, and I'm sure you've all seen it as well, how many times it happens that siblings are caring for parents, and one sibling maybe lives near them, or one sibling is perhaps out of work at the moment and is therefore assigned the task, or whatever the rationale may be, but it becomes a source of bitterness between them in the months and years that follow, because it's a huge burden. You don't need me to tell you that. I shouldn't use the word burden. It's an honor to do it and so on, but nonetheless, it's a huge workload that's involved, and therefore the siblings really need to have the conversation between them on an ongoing basis to number one, so that those who aren't shouldering as much of the workload should be sensitive to what's going on and should know and should be able to express their gratitude, but also so that they can rebalance as the case may be, as may be needed. What happens in terms of making decisions on behalf of the elderly when they are incapacitated? So we dealt with this already in a shiur on capacity to consent, most recently at Shari Shemayim a few months ago, but we did a shiur on this last year here at the Bayit. So just to at least deal with the question, take a look at source number 5. I'm not going to deal with it at length in the way that we did in the capacity shiur. But if you look in source number 5, I brought you an excerpt from the Canadian Medical Association's Code of Ethics. Sorry, I think I'm out of sheets. Oh, there's... thank you, Harold. Source number 5. Ascertain wherever possible and recognize your patient's wishes about the initiation, continuation, or cessation of life-sustaining treatment. When the intentions of an incompetent patient are unknown, and when no formal mechanism for making treatment decisions is in place, render such treatment as you believe to be in accordance with the patient's values, or if these are unknown, the patient's best interests. Meaning there are two standards. One standard is what the patient would say, that's called substituted judgment. The other is what you conceive to be the best interests of the patient. And according to this code of ethics, we should go with substituted judgment. What would the patient have wanted? Not what you would have wanted for the patient. And indeed, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, that is the way that we do it within halacha as well. In source number 6, I brought you a tshuva from Rav Moshe. He says, "Ube'im ha'cholahu tinok." Sorry. He says, "Ube'im ha'cholahu tinok." If a patient is a baby, "Oaf gadol she'ena yodea lahachlit," or he's an adult but he can't make a decision, "Rashayin aviv v'imo v'chala mishpacha lahachlit." So his father, his mother, the entire family are entitled to make the decision on his behalf. "Varishus she'yesh lahem." Mishum derov cholim somchin al das ha'ave ha'aim. The reason why they have the ability to make this decision is because most patients will depend on their parents, ve'af al ha'mishpacha, and on the family, ka'achim v'achayot, ubneihem, their siblings, their children, sharotzim ma'shayoser tov la'achole v'livnei beiso. They want what is best for the patient and for the members of the household. Ukshaleka krovim vada yeshus mochadas based in Sheba. Year, when there are no relatives, so then you depend on the beis din, you depend on the court. So I asked Rav Herschel Schachter about priority among family members related to an earlier shiur on this topic, and he indicated, his response was, that a spouse who has been married to the patient for more than the briefest while is assumed to know best. We assume that the spouse is the one who will know best, and then after that it's going to be the closest relative. It's a matter of common sense. It's a matter of seeing who knows the patient best, which reiterates this idea of substituted judgment. You're trying to figure out what the patient wanted, not what you want on behalf of the patient. And of course, you must note that there will be relevant laws in specific jurisdictions that may govern this as well, and you better be aware of, because those things can come up as well. Okay. Moving from this into a very thorny case, the case of going with live-in help or going with an institution, going with a nursing home and so on, as opposed to doing this personally. This is a very hard decision to make, no surprise, because it's so wrapped up in our relationships with our parents. So how do you decide when it's time to go with an institution, does Judaism even recognize the possibility of doing that? Or is this something where we're really supposed to do this all in our homes, as many people would prefer and may think that they're responsible to do? Certainly, we have a history, as you see in source number 7, of children doing an awful lot for their parents, putting them through incredible things to honor their parents. I brought you one story. In source number 7, the story of Dama ben Netina. Pam achas hayalavush sirkon shel zahav. Once he was wearing a certain golden garment, v'yoshev ben gedolei Romi, and sitting among Roman aristocrats. I should note, Dama ben Netina was not Jewish. So he's held up as a model of honor for one's parents. But he's sitting among these Roman aristocrats. Ubasa imo, and his mother comes along, v'karato mimenu, and she tore it off of him, this golden garment. V'tavcholo arosho, she slapped him on the head. The Yarkal of the Fanav, and she spat in his face. V'lo hechlima, and he did not embarrass her. He took it, and he didn't respond. And the Gemara is filled with stories like this of the honor that children show to their parents. The good thing about stories like this is that it sets the bar. It demonstrates a standard. The bad thing about stories like this is that it sets the bar. Meaning that it creates great pressure on us. Well, if they did this, then surely I am obligated to do this. And if they put up with this, then I have to put up with this. I gave a shiur last week on compromising marriage. And made the same point there regarding the classic story of Rachel and Rabbi Akiva. We're told that according to one version of the history, because there are two versions, Bavli and Avos Rabbi Nasan, but one version of the story is indeed that Rachel sends off Rabbi Akiva to Yeshiva to learn for 12 years, and then he comes back and he hears her say to the neighbor, I wish he would stay for another 12 years, so he goes back for another 12 years, and she puts up with poverty and being without her new husband for 24 years so he can go become Rabbi Akiva. So I said in the Shir that this story is a great story, but it's a terrible story, because it creates such an expectation now. Is that the standard that I'm supposed to have in my marriage? And the same thing is true regarding this. It's a double-edged sword when you look at stories like this. So I bring you also source number 8, also from the Gemara in Kiddushin, the story of Ravasi. Ravasi havale hahi ima zikena. Ravasi's mother was elderly. Amrale, and she said to him, ba'ina tachshitin, I want jewelry. Avadla, so he made her jewelry. Ba'ina gavra, she said, I would like to get married. So he says, na'ayin loch. He said, all right, I'll look for one. You know, J-date or something. I'll try to find somebody. Ba'ina gavra deshabir kavasach. She says, I want one as good as you. And the implication here is that there's dementia involved, and that the relationship is becoming very complicated. And so, what does he do? Shavka ba'azel la'aradi Yisrael. He made aliyah. He couldn't handle the situation. I am now skipping a little bit of the story from the Gemara. Shama la'arona de ka'asi. He heard that his mother's casket had arrived. His mother passed away. Amar, and he said, Iyad Ilonafki. He said, had I known, I would not have left. Now, there's a back and forth in terms of explaining what that last line means, what he's referring to in terms of leaving. But this is quoted quite often as a precedent for the idea of the child saying, I can't do this. I cannot take care of the parent, which leaves us with the Rambam in source number 9. The Rambam in Mishneh Torah and Hilchos Mamrim. Hilchos Mamrim, literally the laws of rebels, includes in it the laws of honoring your parents. I'll leave that to you to digest. But the Rambam writes in source number 9, Misha nitrafa daito shel avivo shel imo. If one's father or mother becomes demented, that's nitrafa daito. Literally, the mind is torn. Mishtadel linhogi mahem kefi da'atam. So he should try to work with them according to their wishes, ad sheyucham aleihen, until Hashem has mercy upon them. And you understand when he says Hashem has mercy upon them, that doesn't necessarily mean they get better. The expression is intentionally vague. Ve'im yi'efsher lo lamod, but if he can't deal with it, b'nei she'nishtatu biyoser, because they've become extremely irrational, yanichem ve'yelech lo, he should leave them, v'yitzava acherim lanhigam kara'oy lahem, and he should instruct others to take care of them in the manner that is appropriate. So the Rambam is sanctioning the idea of saying there has to be a point where others step in. You have to have the option of having others step in. The Ravid, Rabbi Avram ben David, has a problem with the Rambam. He writes on this, I brought it here, it's in the same source. That's all a quote from the Rambam. And he says, Amar Avram ein zu hora nechona. He says, that's an incorrect ruling. If he is going to leave, and then you know, he says, "Lemi itzava l'shomro, whom will he instruct to care for the parent?" What is bothering the Ravid here? What is bothering the Ravid?
Substitute decision making.
Meaning?
Meaning that without the child being present, you're totally deferring, but the individual providing care doesn't know the values and therefore can't make the decisions.
So Albert suggests that maybe the problem is that the child really doesn't know enough to be able to take the caregiver doesn't really know enough. Could be. What else? What else could be the problem bothering the Ravid? Yeah? So Jack is expressing the concern that maybe the caregiver who's going to come in is going to be too strong a presence, if I understand you correctly, and not necessarily appropriate for the specific needs of the parent involved. So those are certainly approaches that one could take to it.
Abuse
is now a third concern. The caregiver isn't going to care well enough, or just the opposite, is going to be a negative presence. Maybe. Yes?
I think he's saying that he said that the suggestion is that the child leave, and he's complaining the child shouldn't be leaving. Right? He's abdicating. He's leaving him the parent totally.
Mm-hmm. Right? So you think that's the objection, is the child leaving the scene entirely? Could be. I think the last three words of Lemi Itzav El Shomro are a little bit hard to take then. The last three words in whom will he instruct still need to be explained. Unless the answer is that the caregiver needs a supervisor.
Right.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Okay.
Yes.
If you're leaving, then who's watching the caregiver to make sure care is given properly? Zev?
Someone's taking issue with Rambam. He must be taking issue on a logical basis, not on the basis of emotional, sociological perspective. So the question I would ask is who is equal? Concept of Shaliach has to have an equal level of responsibility, moral, halakhic obligation. How can one do something?
Right, so Zev is asking, I think, if I understand your point correctly, the child has the obligation, the caregiver does not, and how can you hand this off to somebody else? So these are all good points. On one level, the Ravid is hard to understand. Because the Ravid is contradicting the story of Rav Asi. It sounds like he's saying Rav Asi was wrong. Because Rav Asi did exactly this. So how am I to understand what the Ravid is objecting to? The Rambam is just basing it on a story in the Gemara involving Rav Asi, who's a well-known sage. So there are some of the authorities, Bach, Yamshel Shlomo, Rashash, offer different approaches to discredit the Rav Asi's story as a source, and to say that source isn't adequate. But the Taz, a commentary on Shulchan Aruch, offers another suggestion. He says what's bothering the Ravid is that if others are able to do this, if others are able to take care of the patient, of the parent, why can't he? In other words, you're telling me it's too much for you. Remember, this is in the days before professional care. Right? This is in the days when you don't have homes that are dedicated for this and training for people. So the problem is much more basic. The problem is, if you can't do it, how do you think someone else is going to do it? And if someone else can do it, then why can't you? That's the way the Taz understands the Ravid's objection. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's an asset because not everybody's emotional strength is the same, and maybe he found someone who can handle it better. Number one, number two, he could conceivably, if it's all on him, it's his responsibility. And plus, he's closer, so sometimes he can't make the right decisions. As opposed to, so if you're closer, maybe you should be able to, but sometimes you can't. It's
right.
Emotional makeup. And also, he could replace himself with two people, maybe, who are, you know, if one person is hired, that guy's not going to be 24/7, so maybe it's two people, so they get a break.
Right.
There are answers that right. It could be someone else, could be better.
Right, so there clearly are weaknesses in the objection. There are clear weaknesses, as you pointed out, the emotional state of the child. Maybe the child in particular is not suited for this, but other people would be. Maybe you could get two people to replace him and that way take care of the situation. Maybe being so close to the parents is corrupting his ability to make a decision. He needs someone objective who's going to be able to handle it. All true. The Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham, says that today this is not a consideration. He accepts the Taz's point in understanding the Ravid, but he says today this is clearly not relevant. In source number 10, he writes, "V'nira li, it appears to me, d'ha'id navadai efshar l'chalik bein shmira shel haben, shu eino menusa v'yodea ech lishmor, u'bein ach amosad shemulumadim u'menusim b'davar." He says, today, for sure, you would distinguish between children who are not necessarily experienced, who don't necessarily know what they're supposed to do, and a nurse, and an institution where that's what they're trained to do, and they have the experience to do it properly. They know how to care for someone who is dealing with dementia. Dementia is just one case, obviously. There are other cases where the parent is perfectly lucid, but physically the children can't do the things that are needed for the parent. And he's saying, so you get somebody who is trained for it, who may be physically strong enough for it, or where there's a staff, and therefore multiple people can do this at the same time. That's what you would be looking for. In practice, halachically, we follow this approach. The Shulchan Aruch brings it as halacha. I already brought you the Nishmas Avram. The Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg has a tshuva on this to someone who wanted to know the only way he could take care of his parents safely. The issue was safety, forget respect. Was to tie the parents to a chair at times to make sure they wouldn't fall out of the chair. And the question was, can I do that? That's disrespectful. And Tzitz Eliezer's response is that it's better to work with an institution, and you visit as much as you can, and so on, than to keep the child in the home where that's the way you're going to need to take care of the parent. That was his response. Now, obviously, but it still bears saying, one who's going to put the parent in a nursing home or in some other type of an institution needs to make sure to mitigate the distance the parent now has from the family. That's a very important issue. You know, often people will say, well, I visit them every day. You know, what more can they ask for? Visiting every day is pretty good, and I'm there for an hour and a half every day, and that's certainly very good. That's important. However, recognize that means that there are 22 and a half hours out of the day when they're not with you. What is happening for them during that time? What are they thinking during that time? I'm not suggesting that the child has to be there 24 hours a day, but I'm suggesting that the child has to understand the mind frame of the parent and do whatever is possible to involve them in the family, to involve them in the lives of others, to try to mitigate that reality. There's much more that could be said about this. There's an article by Barry Freundel, Halacha and the Nursing Home Dilemma, put out by the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists in 1990. And that's something that might be worth taking a look at. Okay. We move on to halachic challenges in caring for a parent. This one was asked by quite a few people, so I thought I would deal with it in particular. And it's important for medical professionals to know when advising children of how to take care of their parents. So one issue that comes up is the issue of giving a shot, right? Injecting or drawing blood from a parent for a blood test. So take a look, please, at source number 11, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Maushayakis dam le'aviv, the Gemara asks, may one let blood for his father. The concern is that the Torah says you are not allowed to wound a parent. Makei aviv v'imo, mos yumas, actually it says. It's capitally punishable. So, does one wound a parent? You know, in letting blood is the case they're dealing with in that situation. So Rav Masna amar v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Rav Masna said, of course he should do it. You should love your neighbor as yourself, meaning what you're doing is positive care. They're assuming that venesection, as it's called in a more sophisticated world, is care for the parent. It's part of their medical treatment. Of course you do it. Rav Dimi Bar Chinana Amar Makei Adam Umakei Behema. Rav Dimi Bar Chinana says, look, the Torah juxtaposes the prohibition against striking a parent and the prohibition against striking a beast, an animal. Ma Makei Behema L'Refua Potter, just as if I strike somebody's animal medically, in order to cure it, meaning that I have to draw blood from the animal or something, that's you know, I'm potter, I'm not liable for doing that. Af makei adam l'refua potter. The same thing is true if I strike a person for the sake of medical treatment. So in other words, he says, it's fine, you do what you need to do in order to care for the parent. But then we get a story. Rav lo shavik libre le mishkal alei silva. Rav, one of the greatest authorities of the 3rd century, would not permit his son to remove a thorn from his skin because of concern that it might create a wound, apparently. Mar brei de Ravina lo shavik libre le miftach lei kavsa. I wrote in brackets kivia to explain it. Mar brei de Ravina, if he had a blister, would not allow his son to open the blister. Why? Dilma chavil, lest he wound him, v'havale shigigas iser. He will be violating a prohibition, even though it's only accidental. Nonetheless, these sages would not permit their kids to do that. So the Gemara says, well, wait a minute. If that's really true, that accidentally doing this is such a bad violation, why are you limiting the discussion to taking care of a parent? That's true every time a doctor treats somebody. They draw blood for a blood sample and for some reason doesn't clot properly, whatever, there's a bruise. Now you've wounded somebody. Why isn't that a concern? Ihachi achir nami, it should be prohibited for others as well. I added in the word asur. To which he answers, yeah, but the prohibitions are on different levels. Achir shigigas lav. Beno shigigas chenek. If you do that in treating somebody else to whom you're not related, and you make a mistake, so it's a mistake on a very ground-level prohibition. With a parent, it's a capital crime to wound a parent. Therefore, it's much more serious. So the Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in a responsum on this, in his Mincha Shlomo, it's Chelek Aleph, Tshuva Lamed Beis, for anyone who wants to take a look at it, quotes many sources to justify the ability of a parent to be mochel, to forgive his honor and say, son, daughter, I'd like you to please, you know, whatever it is. Do the injection, take the blood, whatever. So if so, what was Rav concerned about? Why wouldn't Rav allow his son to do it? Two different opinions. Source number 12, Ramban Nachmanides in his Taras HaAdam writes, Dilma chavel beit fei mimashu b'derech harafua v'havalei shigigas chenek. The statement by Ramban is, lest he wound him beyond the normal way of medicine. In other words, in the event that I treat my parent, and inherent in the treatment is that it's going to create a bruise, that's fine. But the concern is I don't do a good job. What if I, in trying to do this, don't do it in the optimal way, and thereby I create a wound? That's Ramban. The Ran disagreed, Rabbeinu Nissim. Rabbeinu Nissim argues, if that were true, then I would go back to the Gemara's point. All medical treatment would be prohibited. Because that can always happen. In any case, granted with a parent, it's worse. But still, that's something you'd be concerned about in any case. He says, a doctor who accidentally harms somebody is called ones. It happened against his will. It's not even shogeg. It's not even called an accidental violation. It was something that happened against his best intentions. So therefore, the Ran offers a second approach. He says in source 13, Shema yase chabur la'aviv lelo tzarich, sheyach shov litol ha-silva v'yechablu b'makom acher. The concern is, you're pulling out the thorn from this spot, and you jab it into another spot by accident. Something entirely separate from the medical act might take place. That's what he's worried about. That in the course of doing this, you end up doing something that is actually entirely different. Ramban offers a different approach altogether. In addition to this, he says, you know what? The reason why the child shouldn't do it is because the child can leave it for others. That's why Rav doesn't want his son doing it. He says, because the son can ask somebody else. Whereas in general medicine, if every doctor is going to say, well, lest I wound you, then you won't have any doctors to do it. But the child has the ability to ask somebody else. Yes? Good. So Jack asks, well, what if he's the only doctor available? I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But the way that the Ramban addresses it is to say, you could always ask somebody else. It doesn't have to be you. In fact, as a matter of practice, source number 14, the Menchas Chinuch says, you don't need to worry about this at all. He says, Hanu amorai delo hirshu libneim litolam coats, Hainu dilma yasu chavala shalo letzarech b'shogeg shalo meretzon aviv. Rabbi Yosef Babad has an entirely different take on the issue. He says, parents do forgive. Just like I said, Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach brings sources. He says, parents do forgive it. That's not the problem. The problem is what happens where the child's accidental injury to the parent goes beyond what the parent was willing to forgive. In other words, he messes up and the parent isn't happy about this and isn't forgiving of it. That's where you're going to run into trouble. That's the way the Menchas Chinuch frames it. He says if the parent forgives, there's no problem, child or somebody else. The concern is what happens if you do more than what the parent was willing to take. So the poskim who deal with this tend to take the view that I quoted from Ramban. If you take a look at source 15, the Rambam, again in Hilchos Mamrim, the laws of rebels, writes, Hamakis dam le'aviv, one who lets blood for his father. And there's no difference, father or mother. It just happens to be that we mention the father as one unit. Oshaya rofe, v'chatach lo'basar o'iver. Or the kid is a doctor, and he amputates some flesh or a limb from the father. Pater, he's exempt from liability. Av apishu pater lechatchila, granted he's exempt, I'm sorry, apishu pater, even though he is exempt from liability, lechatchila lo yase. Ideally, he shouldn't do this. Olahotzi silon mi besara vivo ima, or pulling out a thorn. He shouldn't do that. Lo yotzi shema yase chabura, lest he bruise them. Bamed rav amurim. But what does that assume? When is that true? Kishayesham achir laasos, where there is someone else who could do this. Avalim ein sham mishayase elohu. But if he is the only one who's able to do this, like the case where he's the only doctor in town, Varein mitstarin, and they're in pain. Hareze makiz v'chotech kifima sheyirsheyu lasos. He should cut, he should let blood, and do whatever they permit him to do. If he's the only one who can do it, then indeed he should do it.
He's not the only one, but he's the best one to do it.
Right.
Everybody else is less.
So flip. Good question. Flip the page. First of all, let's see source 16, but then I'm going to get to your question. Source 16, the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. The Shulchan Aruch says, where the father is jabbed with a thorn, he shouldn't remove it. I mean, in the interest of time, I'm not reading the Hebrew aloud, but you can see it there in front of you. Where the father is jabbed with a thorn, he should not remove it, lest he bruise him. The same is true in letting blood. And he doesn't give you the leniency of, what if you're the only doctor in town? The Rav Moshe Isserles then says, well, that assumes there is another who can do it. If there's no one else to do it, he's in pain, the son should let blood and cut him as he permits. So the Ben Ish Chai thinks that the Rama is just explaining the Shulchan Aruch, that everybody agrees with the Rambam that where there's no one else, you should do it. Rav Shlomo Zalman disagrees and says, no, it actually seems to be a machlokes, which is important because that means that Sfardim may actually be stuck. The law for Sfaradim may be stricter than for Ashkenazim because the Shulchan Aruch does not bring the heter of you're the only one who can do it. But the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chiyon Bechel Epstein, writing in the beginning of the 20th century in source 17, goes back to Ilana's point. He says, "Im ein sham mishayase elohu," where there is no other one to do it, and the parents are in pain, he lets blood and cuts as they permit, which the Ramah said, but then he adds, The same is true if he is better than others, and his father wishes that he do it, he may do it. It isn't only about him being the only one in town. If he is the preferred option for the parent says, I don't want to go to some doctor somewhere. I'd rather have you take care of it. I put you through medical school for a reason. Then indeed, the child should do it. Where that's the parent's preference, then the child would go ahead and do it. The Mincha Shlomo of Shlomo Zalman notes, I brought it in source 18, he says, if you're dealing with a procedure that normally does not cause wounding, bruising, then the child certainly should do it without any hesitation. He's talking about injections. That was the question that he was asked. And he says, yes, the child would do it without any hesitation. Where it does cause bruising, then we go back to the point of the parent forgiving it, where it's part of the normal course of things, and the Minchas Chinuch saying for sure that the child can do it without concern. But where there is another option, perhaps that would be better. Now, what if the other option requires paying? Right? What if you could go to a clinic and have it done at a clinic, but there's money to be paid in order for that to happen? It's not covered by OHIP, whatever the case may be. Or the child can do it, and the child's going to do it for free. The parent wants the kid to do it. It says, I don't want to spend any money on this. Is the child required to spend his own money in order to hire somebody to take care of the parent? So, the Gemara in Kiddushin talks about this issue of who has to spend for Kibud Av V'Em in source number 19. The ruling there is that children are not obligated to spend money for Kibud Av V'Em, for honor of the parent. Mind you, the Rama notes, or Moshe Isserlis notes, that in terms of general honor for parents, not dealing with medical care, but general honor for parents, if the parent doesn't have the money to do things personally, then the child will have to spend it anyway for tzedakah for the parent. Your first obligation is to family. That's a separate note. But what do we say here? Is the child obligated to spend money in order to get someone to inject the parent or to draw blood from the parent or whatever the case may be? So two approaches. One is the approach of the Minchas Chinuch. The Minchas Chinuch we've already seen says the parent forgives it, you can do whatever you need to do. The parent is saying, I want you to be the one to care for me. Then there is no obligation for the child to go out and hire somebody else. The parent is okay with whatever the results are. And the poskim tend to side with him. However, there is a second approach from the Gesher HaChaim, Rabbi Chiel Michal Takachinsky, the classic work on Avelus, on mourning, also deals with care of those who are ill. And he argues that if one would need to pay, his statement is that the child does get to do it, but the point that he makes in order to justify it is to say, if you would need to pay, it's as though no other option is available. In other words, I view this as the equivalent of there is no other doctor in town because you're available to do it for free. That's the statement that he makes. There are those who disagree with this. For example, the Har Tzvi of Tzvi Pesach Frank, he points out the case of spending money to travel to see one's parents. You know the classic story, right? The kid who goes to his Rebbe and says, I think I'm exempt from visiting my parents, my elderly parents, because they live really far away, and I would have to pay for a train ticket in order to do that, and I don't have to pay in order to go visit my parents, because that's paying for Kibud Av V'Em. So his Rebbe looks at him and says, you're right, start walking. The Har Tzvi of Tzvi Pesach Frank brings this in his tshuva. He doesn't bring it as a story. He brings it as a matter-of-fact statement. He says, the child doesn't have the option of saying, well, it's expensive and you don't have to pay and therefore you're exempt. He has to find some other way to do it. And so Tzvi Pesach Frank actually argues that in the case of the child caring for the parent and doing something which is going to draw blood from the parent that potentially wound the parent, he says, the child, why does the child have to to pay for travel. Because he's not really paying for the parent's sake, he's paying for his own sake. He has an obligation to go visit the parent by walking. The fact that he is paying is for himself, to make life easier for himself so he can take a train instead of going on foot. And the same thing is true, argues with Pesach Frank, in terms of drawing blood from the parent. He says, your obligation is to make sure that blood is drawn from the parent. You could do it yourself. You want to avoid being liable in case you bruise the parent, so you spend money on it. You're spending money for your own sake. So he actually opposes, as did Yitzhak Halevi Herzog for other reasons, one of the chief rabbis of the state of Israel, or before it was a state, in the first half of the 20th century. He also opposed it and argued that the child would have to spend to get somebody else to do this. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach disagrees. Many halachic authorities disagree. The upshot in practice for people, and again, consult the shul rabbi as a matter of psak, but the upshot among halachic authorities that I saw does seem to be that where the parent wants the child to do this, the child need not spend the money to go get somebody else to do it, assuming the child is reasonably proficient, such that they know that they're not likely to wound the parent. Where it's not possible, you know, people as they age may become vulnerable to bruising very easily. And at that point, there may be a real concern that this is going to bruise the parent. So where it's doable to get somebody else, whether that's a visiting nurse or whether that's going to a home or whatever, that indeed may be the stronger option for people.
But then you've created one problem for those people needing daily injections of blood thinners.
Yeah.
Which are guaranteed to cause bruising.
Right.
You've made a black and white statement. You can't do it at all.
I did not. I said you may want to look at it. I leave it to the rabbi to make the black and white statement. The answer indeed is a machlokas. It's fundamentally a machlokas. There are other factors that have to be weighed. You know, when I say go to the shul rabbi, it's not just a tagline. It's because each case involves factors that are unique. For example, let's say the parent who needs blood thinners also is suffering from dementia. And therefore, taking the parent to somebody, or even having a stranger come in to draw the blood, is going to be far worse for the parent's state of mind, potentially, than having the child do this and accepting the bruise that goes with it. There really are specific factors for the situation, and I don't intend anything black and white. Okay. The next case that I wanted to address is a big one. Several people asked me about this, and it comes up, unfortunately, realistically, in care of one's elders. The parent needs help bathing. The parent needs help using the washroom. The parent needs cream applied to skin, and that may be in parts of the body that are normally covered. So is a child able to do this? So take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 20. Maseches Semachos. Maseches Semachos is one of the many tractates that were appended to the Talmud. It's not one of the major volumes. It's written a little bit later, perhaps, than the other volumes. But the lesson recorded here appears in the Gemara as well. But take a look at source number 20. Im hakol adam nichnas lebeis hamerchatz. One may enter a bathhouse with anyone. We are assuming same gender. We're assuming that males with males, women with women. Chutz me aviv v'chamiv ubal imo v'rabo shalim do chachma. Except for his father, father-in-law, stepfather, or rabbi who has taught him wisdom. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda says, if his fatherly is elderly or ill, one may enter and bathe him. This is his honor. This is his honor. You're according him honor by taking care of the parent. The Tanakhama, the first view that says you can't go in with them. What's the reason? Why can't you go in with them?
Rivat Avicha is a statement about actual sexual impropriety. Sorry?
We learn from Noach, right? Honor, right? Honor is the simple answer. The issue is, it's not respectful to them to see them in that state. That's one answer. What else could be the answer? So there's a separate consideration. Take a look at source number 21. When we bathe with anyone other than father, father-in-law, stepfather, or sister's husband, that wasn't in the original source. No, that's in this one in the Gemara. Rabbi Yehuda matir be'aviv, Rabbi Yehuda permits with his father, mipnei kavod aviv, for his father's honor, as well as with his stepfather. Tana, we learned separately, it was taught, Talmud lo yirchatzim rabo, v'im rabo tzarech lo mutter, a student may not bathe with his rabbi, but it is permitted where his rabbi needs him. You see what happened in this source, in source 21? Here, the leniency of, you may do it if he needs you, is stated separately for one's rabbi, not in the context of a parent. Rashi on this Gemara understands that there's actually a separate concern dealing with a parent. And it may sound odd, but the way that Rashi understands the concern is that the man sees his father in an undressed state. He sees that which produced him, and it causes inappropriate thoughts in the child. That's the second concern that's mentioned. Aside from the concern for honor, there's a concern for what is going through the kid's mind, and that being something that can lead him in an inappropriate direction at some other point in time. Not with the parent, but with somebody else. So that's a second concern that's involved. So what we see here is, one source saying, don't go in. Rabbi Yehuda saying, if it's for his honor, then you do it. The Tanakhama, the first view, does not present that leniency. So what we have fundamentally is a machlokes. We have a debate. What happens in practice? Source number 22, the Rambam, Maimonides. One may not enter the bathhouse with his father, sister's husband, or student. He puts the onus on the Rebbe not to go in with the student. It is permitted when he needs his student. He doesn't mention the leniency. He doesn't mention anything about the leniency of taking care of the parent. He mentioned the student taking care of his Rebbe. He doesn't mention the child taking care of the parent. As a matter of fact, the Shulchan Aruch does the same thing. The Shulchan Aruch does not bring the Shulchan Aruch doesn't bring the issue in general. But the Ramah does not bring, or Moshe Isserles does not bring the leniency. The Chuvos Shevet Halevi, Rav Wozner, and the Menachas Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Weiss, address this. And what they write is that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch indeed believe that the child is not allowed to do this on behalf of the parent. Because they are siding with the Tanakhama with the first view, and he believes it's not a matter of honor. If it's only a matter of honor, like taking care of your Rebbe, then if the Rebbe needs you, that is his honor. But with a parent, it's not just honor, it's also the concern for impropriety, and that won't be even overridden by need. Now, is that what we're stuck with then? Is that our conclusion? Not necessarily, for several reasons. Number one, the concern for impropriety does not seem to extend to a mother and daughter. That's number one, just in general. That concern does not appear to be there. But second, take a look at source number 23, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Ashkenazi edition addendum to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law. He says, the practice of entering a bathhouse with one's rabbi, father, father-in-law, stepfather, and sister's husband has spread despite the Talmud's prohibition. Why? Because people now enter wearing pants. They cover themselves up in the bathhouse. So therefore, a second approach is to cover the parts that are supposed to be covered to the extent possible. Third and most important is that all the halachic authorities on this agree that when you're dealing with somebody who is in danger of falling, then for sure the child should be going in and taking care of the parent and doing the bathing of the parent in order to keep the parent safe. None of this is discussing where safety is a consideration. They're discussing only the issue of the non-safety situations. The Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham, takes a different stance on this altogether. His stance with the approval of Rabbi Yeshua Neuvert goes back to a discussion we had in a shir last year, the year before, when we talked about male and female doctors taking care of the opposite gender. And what we said there was, when one is engaged in medical care,
and we dealt with the yichud problem of being alone, making sure somebody else is able to come in, and so on. But where you're giving somebody medical care, we assume that arayos are not going to be an issue. Thoughts of impropriety are not going to be an issue. Granted, we try to mitigate that wherever we can, but that still exists. And on that basis, his ruling is that if you don't have the option of having somebody else do it, you would be the one to bathe the parent, you would be the one to apply the ointment to the parent, and so on. You do it in the most respectful way possible. You know, you cover up whatever can be covered up at the time. It's not right to treat the parent in any different way, but but you would be the one to do it. And he includes within it, I asked him, I emailed him just to get clarity on this because it wasn't explicit in his Nishmas Avram, but he clarified by that he means even for the daughter to take care of the father, cross gender, would still be acceptable. That's the ruling that he gave. So to summarize on these last two points that we've done, number one, in terms of taking the blood or doing something else that may wound, if you can get somebody else in a way that will not diminish the care of the parent, that would be ideal. But otherwise, you would indeed do it. The parent assuming the parent is okay with it, obviously. That's number one. Number two is that in terms of caring for the parent in ways that may offend the parent's honor, again, assuming the parent is okay with it, the child would indeed do it, assuming that no one else is available to do so. That's the broad statement without the nuances that you can see within the sources. I wanted to cover two last small issues, just one-liner issues, because they were asked and they fit into this general context. Getting a parent to eat versus kavod, versus the parent's honor. So here, there's no issue of erva. The issue is only kavod. The issue is only the honor of the parent. We have already said that everyone is going to agree, Rabbi Yehuda and the Tanakhama, both of them in the source regarding bathing, will agree that helping someone for his own sake is his honor. Therefore, one would be able to, indeed, compel the parent, for the parent's sake, to eat. It should be done in the most respectful way possible, obviously. And keep in mind what we quoted from Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg earlier, where we said that it's better to work with an institution and outside care than to have to tie somebody down. There does have to come a point where you're going to go with some kind of outside care professionals to help. However, it's clear that where a child is trying to get a parent to eat, and it may not be consistent with the parent's honor, the child should still be doing so. It should still be trying to get the parent to eat, understanding that it may not be the most respectful treatment of the parent.
Does this extend to two feet as well?
Well, the two different questions come up for the two feet. You're talking about getting the parent to accept the feeding tube? Right, so I'm going to hold that one off. That was asked as one of the topics in the email, but because feeding tubes are really their own topic, whether that counts as feeding or it's an extraordinary measure, and there are too many unique circumstances, I didn't want to go there. The second of the small issues that was asked was advocating for removal of the parent's driver's license. So we discussed this last year when we had a class on patient confidentiality. And we talked about the doctor who sees a patient and feels the patient should not be driving, and whether the doctor is supposed to tell anybody or whether he has to honor the confidentiality of the patient. And our answer was unequivocal. All of the poskim, all the halachic authorities are in lockstep on this, that you are obligated to tell. You are obligated to make sure that the driver's license is removed because it's pikuach nefesh. It's a matter of saving the lives of others. Now, I fully recognize that even that is not black and white because there's always this gray area of, well, they could drive, they only go locally, and therefore whatever. But remember, when we're dealing with life and death, and when someone is driving a vehicle, it is life and death. We err on the side of caution. I say that knowing full well that it's easier said than done. I've been unfortunately involved in cases where that had to be carried out, and I know that we're talking about something very difficult. But that's the weight of halachic opinion on it. I apologize for rushing so much with this. I have the 10 o'clock Yom Iyun afterwards. I am going to email around for follow up, God willing, and.
I forgot the sign.
and I will yes, and I will and I'll entertain questions that way. Please make sure that you have signed in. There are sign-in sheets in a couple of places here. That's the only thing that will enable me to actually email you for follow-up. And also, if you want to be able to get CME credit, you have to sign in. There's no other way that we can get you a certificate. Once again, I would like to thank the Nathansons. I'd like to thank Qualicare for sponsoring this session and the series, both here and at Shire Shemayim. And I also want to thank Stu Haver, who I noticed